The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week...
The eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432. Wow.
Now MPs have made clear what they don't want. We must all work constructively together to set out what Parliament does want. That's why I'm inviting MPs from all parties to come together to find a way forward.
After MPs delivered a thumping defeat to Theresa May's withdrawal agreement, there's one question on everyone's minds. What's Plan B? And if Plan B turns out to look a lot like Plan A, then what's Plan C? And will anyone agree on it anyway? Also this week, as Brexit grinds on with no end in sight, is it leading to a lost generation of public services? That's all on this week's Politics Weekly. But first, to nobody's great surprise, Theresa May suffered a crushing defeat on Tuesday as her withdrawal agreement was rejected by a margin of 230 votes. This prompted a motion of no confidence from Jeremy Corbyn, which was, to no one's great surprise either, defeated the next day. May promised to consult with MPs with the widest possible range of views, but showed no sign of budging on her red lines, including membership of a customs union. Jeremy Corbyn then refused to be consulted anyway, unless no deal was taken off the table, and offered little hope to his own supporters who wanted a change of direction towards a second referendum. So 2 days on from the biggest parliamentary defeat in history, with government and parliament still in deadlock, has anything much changed? We'll discuss all this and more in today's show. But first, I spoke to Tory rebel Simon Clarke, Tory loyalist Richard Graham, and Labour's Siobhan McDonough about Tuesday's historic vote, and began by asking Simon what it felt like in Westminster.
Well, like all of these things, there are different feelings at different parts of the day. There was a little skitter of sort of butterflies at sort of 4 or 5 o'clock when you know that the moment's coming. But the truth is that those colleagues who were sort of in agonies until the last moment will have had a much harder day than I did, because I was clear from the outset, as you say, I've been clear for some time, this deal isn't right, and therefore the only option was to vote it down. And that, in that sense, there were no sort of terrors on the day.
And what was it like inside that no lobby? It's quite weird to see some of those pictures of Labour MPs and Boris Johnson and MPs like yourself just all huddled together in a really packed lobby.
Yes, it's like the sort of tube train from hell would be the best description I've got, really. Because you don't come into politics to rebel. I, like all MPs, do feel a loyalty and affinity to my own party, my own friends, and it's not nice to be separated in that way, but I think, you know, there was a sort of weird sense of camaraderie as well, that obviously this had an element of novelty. Human beings like novelty. It was all quite good-spirited. What will remain with me is the sadness, though, as well, that it came to this. We didn't need to be in this place, and that is my lasting regret. It will be a regret I'll carry with me probably for the rest of my life, that these negotiations have been so profoundly mishandled, that they have brought us to a place where 118 Conservative members of Parliament vote against their own government on the central issue of its policy. That is a devastating indictment of a bad plan and poor choices from the leadership.
Here's Richard Graham.
There was a moment when I looked around, when the Speaker said, "All those in favour say aye." I looked around and I saw too many faces around me that weren't saying anything, and then joined in the, you know, "All those against, no." And I thought, there's more, and some of the faces are not ones I was expecting to be there.
What's the mood like sort of the day after, the night before? Is there a mood for compromise? Are people looking for ladders to climb down? Or are people thinking, well, you know, we can really push for whatever we want now, it's sort of open season?
There are a lot of conversations going on at the moment, translating what the Prime Minister's commitment to hold talks with parliamentarians from all different parties and what that will translate into, whether there is a sort of cross-party consensus that a soft Brexit solution is actually the one thing that could command a majority in the House of Commons, is, you know, all of that is a moot point. I suspect that is where you could get a consensus, but it comes at a cost, which is huge division in our party and actually possibly in Labour as well.
Siobhan McDonough.
It seemed quite calm. People had decided how they were going to vote, so there wasn't any issue about that. When it actually came to the vote, there was quite a carnival atmosphere about, which seems extraordinary given the importance it is to our country, the economy, its people, absolutely everything. But, you know, in the lobby, there were people taking selfies, there were people cheering. And I understand that outside at the rally, there were people of all sorts of different views in favour of Brexit, wanting a people's vote, all cheering and laughing. It seems that everybody thought they were getting what they wanted, but actually nobody's got anything of what they want.
And there really weren't very many, you know, there's predictions of quite a few Labour rebels, but there really weren't very many of your... So your whips didn't really have a great deal to do yesterday.
No, I think that... That was the purest vote. Everybody got to express the feeling as they saw it. There was no need to compromise because everybody assumes that it's coming back.
And what is it like today, finally? Is it a bit of a different atmosphere? Are people more worried and uncertain about the future, or is it still a sort of atmosphere of celebration for those who wanted it to go down?
I think there's a more of a pensive atmosphere of, well, what now?
Simon Clark, Richard Graham and Siobhan McDonough there. Well, I'm joined this week by my expert panel. In Westminster, The Guardian's Raphael Baer, Owen Jones and Henry Newman from Open Europe. So, Raph, Siobhan McDonough talked there about a carnival atmosphere and that there was rejoicing in the streets on Tuesday from both the people's vote and people who want no deal. But both sides can't have won, can they?
Well, exactly. And actually, I think there was the opposite of a carnival atmosphere, certainly inside the chamber and afterwards. I think actually the gravity of what had happened really hit home quite quickly. I was struck by quite a few MPs, you know, people who'd voted against the deal and some ministers who'd voted for it, but just realising the simple truth of the situation is there are now kind of 70, 71 days before we leave the European Union, and the only deal that was on the table has been incinerated. And that just has to make the possibility of leaving the EU with no deal a little bit more likely. Now, there were people who would support a softer Brexit or even a referendum who say, no, the opposite is true. There's no parliamentary majority for no deal. And therefore, actually, this sort of tilts everything in a more Remain-y direction. And so sort of where you, that I think seems to come down to as much to temperament as judgment. I think slightly optimistic Remain people think this is great news, and pessimistic Remain people think, oh, here we go, we're all sliding towards no deal. The simple reality is that no one knows, but the people who have the responsibility in the chamber, you know, lawmakers for deciding what happens, not many of them in the sort of mulchy mainstream middle of parliament seemed particularly jolly. Or there was some forced jollity, you know, in sort of the strangers bar afterwards, though there was some champagne being drunk and some sort of low level rowdiness, as it were. But it felt a bit forced to me. I think people are getting nervous.
Henry, Theresa May closed the debate by saying, you know, this is the most important vote of your life. You know, think again, take a second look. But no one really did. In fact, people seem to have made up their minds up a long time ago. Why do you think those kind of arguments didn't work?
Many reasons. I think the Prime Minister is a very bad salesperson, even of her own policy. And also, I think some of the problems with what we're seeing at the moment are not actually related to the substance of the deal. There are personal problems that people have with the Prime Minister, and there are political problems. But I disagreed with what I just heard. I don't think this deal is incinerated. I think there are still three basic options. It's coming to the end of a very bumpy week in Westminster. Those options are no deal, which is very problematic and would be, I think, resisted by a lot of parliamentarians. Not stopping Brexit, and we saw that a big Labour Remain event for a second referendum failed to attract many people, or a version of the Prime Minister's deal. And I think we'll come back to that later on. I also think that actually the mood on the Conservative side has really rallied. Michael Gove, my former boss, gave an extraordinary speech in the Commons, which was, I was there in the chamber, it was extremely exciting, and it unified the Conservative benches. And to a degree, I think Jeremy Corbyn's strategy of calling that confidence vote has backfired, because it's changed the narrative away from the defeat the Prime Minister suffered in the Commons towards actually reminding people about why they're Conservatives and why they're all together on the same side. And equally, I think it exposed quite a few divisions on the Labour side.
Do you think that there are, of those 118 Tory MPs, how many of them are looking for a ladder to climb down?
There are some Tory MPs who are looking for a ladder to climb down, and there are some Tory MPs who are looking for crosses to crucify themselves on. And the problem is that the Prime Minister has fired the gun on her own leadership race to succeed her, and that means it's to a degree open season. So I think there are critics on both sides of the debate who are implacably opposed to any compromise and have got their eyes on a future prize. But ultimately, I think the danger for them is that if they refuse compromise, at least one of those two extremes is going to have to be ultimately disappointed, because you can't have both a no-deal Brexit and a second referendum. One of those at least has to be disappointed. So I think, you know, the Prime Minister's deal is very few people's first choice, but can it be enough people's second choice?
Yeah, I'd agree with Henry actually about the what happened in the chamber yesterday with the no-confidence vote. The sense that actually one of the most resilient forces in British politics through all this turmoil and change turns out to be just tribal Labour Tory allegiance and division, and given the opportunity to remind themselves where they stand on that divide, pretty much everyone in Parliament sort of remembered and discovered their affection for whichever colour flag they liked to wave.
Really, the Labour benches sounded quite quiet to me. I thought Tom Watson's speech was a bit flat. I thought we saw John Woodcock, obviously now standing as an independent, but nonetheless was, you know, on the verge of distancing himself completely from Jeremy Corbyn.
So John Woodcock's a real ally, but the extraordinary thing is we know that there are an awful lot of Labour MPs who don't think Jeremy Corbyn should be Prime Minister, and actually were quite relieved that Parliament wasn't dissolved yesterday and there isn't going to be a general election. And yet, what are they doing? They're still sort of trying to pretend that there's a position you can get that Jeremy Corbyn will be behind. Ultimately, their sense of themselves as Labour and their desire to have a position that can simultaneously be Remain and Labour is so strong that they don't come out and say, well, look, we're just going to do something Remainian. We don't really care what the leader of the Labour Party thinks. Why aren't they doing that? The answer is basically tribal attachment to the Labour Party.
So wait, I want to come back to the no confidence vote a bit later on, but let's just stick on the withdrawal agreement vote for the beginning of the week for a bit. And I want to talk to Owen a bit about, in fact, the Labour whipping operation was pretty solid. I mean, there were three Labour MPs who voted with the government. And why do you think that was, Owen?
Well, there were predictions, weren't there, that, for example, Caroline Flint might have voted with the government, maybe even Gloria De Piero, maybe, for example, Lisa Nandy, though she ruled that out, actually, to be fair, back in November. I mean, I think, you know, there was always the issue there of, you know, there were those who rebelled on the EA last year, who thought actually Labour's position of abstaining wasn't going far enough. Actually, they were being more Brexity, but they weren't going to vote for this. The same, obviously, with the Labour right Brexiteers, if you like, Kate Hoey, because there was John Mann, obviously, who voted for it.
Which... we had Kevin
Barron. Kevin Barron. Good old Barron.
And Ian Austin.
And Ian Austin.
The other one, yeah.
Those were the only three, but it was interesting. It was the fact that those Labour right, Frank Field obviously doesn't have the whip, Kate Hoey didn't either. So clearly, I mean, that just shows the extent to which...
But Kate Hoey didn't, because the DUP were against it, and if the DUP are against it, Kate Hoey's
well, indeed, the DUP member for Vauxhall didn't vote with it accordingly, of course. Yeah, so it was, I think, you know, the fact that the Tory rebels were on the upper side, but also the Labour rebels were on the lower side. So it's for the birds. The idea, if Theresa May's advisers thought that she could come back and somehow appeal over the head of the Labour leadership to win a significant chunk of the parliamentary Labour Party, with some concessions, for example, on workers' rights, that would bring them over. That's not going to happen given that scale. Just on the no confidence vote, Labour were never going to win that. It's for the fantastical. But what were they supposed to do? I mean, for weeks they've been trolled over not calling a vote of no confidence. And it's true that the only thing uniting a fractious and divided Conservative Party, bitterly divided, is the utter terror of a Corbyn-led government coming to power in a general election. The reason for that, one way of breaking the parliamentary deadlock, if the Conservatives were confident, would be to call a general election. But given they started the last election 24 points, Labour 24 points behind the Conservatives and ended 2 points behind, and given on the day of the general election, two polls showed Labour 12 and 13 points behind, I don't think looking at the polling average with Labour slightly ahead, they're in any mood to call a general election, because they that's the only thing that unites anyone from Anna Soubry to Jacob Rees-Mogg. But I don't think that's a sign of Conservative strength in a sense. It's perversely, it's a sign of weakness. It's a sense of a lack of confidence when it comes to it in a general election.
Can we just go back a second to the sort of Labour position in that vote? I think it was completely unsurprising that very few Labour MPs were tempted to come across, because this was the first go. So obviously, when this vote was... Everyone knows that this deal is going to be reintroduced in some form. You spoke at the beginning, Jessica, about whether there was any sort of plan B or plan C. The reality is there isn't, to some degree, and that's not because of the Prime Minister's stubbornness. She is certainly a stubborn person at times. But there is only one deal that has been agreed with the EU. So you can dress that deal up with a different bow, but it's still the same deal. And even those explicitly claiming to have a plan B, such as Norway Plus, Their plan B is premised on accepting the whole of plan A. All the binding bits, the withdrawal agreement, are part of the Norway plan. They just want to tweak the non-binding bits on the political declaration.
Well, on that, it would need obviously a new political declaration. But obviously, if her withdrawal agreement goes through, then she has no political incentive whatsoever to go towards Norway Plus. We'll go towards basically what will happen is by the end of 2021, we'll end up on a cliff edge. We'll have to basically kowtow to the EU's demands on a free trade agreement. Otherwise, we go to a two-year extension where we have to spend another £22 billion. So there's no way. I mean, this. I know everyone says, well, you can't, unless the Norway Plus is predicated or something like that on the withdrawal agreement passing. But if the withdrawal agreement passes, then the direction of travel will be dictated by Theresa May's red lines and her priorities.
Well, she obviously, assuming she continues to form the government, which I think is likely. I think, though, that actually the reason that there is a possibility that you're just raising of that cliff edge coming in the middle of 2020 when we have to decide whether to extend the transition or not is because the government has been going around saying that they'll do everything possible to avoid the backstop. I think that's a strategic mistake. The government should say, look, the backstop is the baseline of the future relationship we can have with the European Union. That backstop provides for a customs union, which can only be exited by mutual agreement. That is what Labour are asking for. So Labour are voting against a deal that has at its core a customs union.
One of the things that really struck me, which I didn't think had an awful lot of pickup, when Geoffrey Cox was giving his opening speech on the last day of the debate, he said in response to one MP, you know that this, what is going to come back is something very, you know, if we vote again, it's going to be on something pretty similar. I'm paraphrasing there, but he basically said that the plan B was to bring this back again. Maybe you get some minor tweaks, maybe you'll get some minor reassurances, but that's the plan again. And Raph, do you think that when that happens, do you think we'll see a smaller majority or do you think people's minds are sort of set in stone now?
Well, I think Henry's underlying point is right, that the withdrawal agreement itself is broadly the foundation on which any deal that the EU can do will proceed. Although if you had, I think, a sense that there was a move towards a political declaration, some consensus on a different political declaration, that then required some tweaks to the withdrawal agreement on the European side, you extend Article 50, then you get a sense there is some goodwill in that direction. One of the interesting dynamics to emerge from the last 48 hours is that on consecutive days, you've seen that the Prime Minister simply doesn't have a command of the Commons to do a deal at the moment on the basis of the withdrawal agreement. And she doesn't have the confidence without the DUP, which has a very strict and narrow sense of what they would find acceptable. It essentially involves taking out the backstop. So that's a definite impasse. I think really then it will come down to this question of at what point and by what mechanism do you get potentially dozens, scores of Labour MPs to switch over? And I think fear of no deal will partly do that. I think Owen's absolutely right that the idea that the Labour MPs are suddenly going to just start doing things that will prop up a Tory government and facilitate the Tory Brexit, if you frame it that way, is a bit fanciful. And I think number 10... and the Prime Minister have been very naive in thinking that somehow there are a load of biddable Labour MPs who, because they don't like Jeremy Corbyn, they would there, and they also want to sort of manage Brexit, that they were biddable. I think that's a misjudgment. But I can also envisage a situation where ultimately I think the Labour leadership, they don't want a referendum. They don't really want to be seen to be complicit in a no-deal Brexit, because I think they've understood now that if that happens, everyone loses. There's just a mess is everywhere on everyone. Everyone's tarred by it. So if there's some way through, you know, indicative free votes, a sort of slight loosening of the whip, and a bit of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you give permission to some Labour MPs to support something on the basis of the withdrawal agreement, and then you can put whatever you like, pretty much, in a political declaration. I can envisage that as a way forward. But it does basically involve the current withdrawal agreement with maybe some extra assurance. I mean, how you get a DUP on board with that is a big mystery, to be honest.
So I was at a dinner at a European embassy just before Christmas where the food was delicious and the conversation was interesting. And I wasn't doing Dry January. So it was more of a fun occasion. But there was a senior Labour backbencher there, not somebody close to Corbyn, but certainly somebody influential within the party. And this backbencher was, we were sort of trying to press them on their reasons, substantive reasons for opposing the deal. And a lot of it, there were some substantive reasons I felt they were pretty far-fetched. But what I was particularly struck by was the comments towards the end of this discussion, which was, I'm not voting for this deal in January. And that sort of in January bit was repeated several times. And I think that, exactly as Raphael was saying, Labour MPs obviously had to vote against the deal first time. But ultimately, is there a compromise that can be found that might not necessarily win the front bench, but might allow certain backbenchers to decide ultimately, particularly those who represent seats in Leave supporting areas where their constituents are very hostile to the idea of a second referendum? They might be persuaded to come down.
I think if it wasn't for the fact that we've just had the biggest defeat in the history of British parliamentary democracy, that would be maybe plausible. But when you've got a 230 majority defeat by the government, you know, even if you halve that, you're down to a catastrophic defeat, which itself would be of historic proportions, it'd be 115 instead. The idea that, you know, if it had been, I don't know, 50, 60, then perhaps Labour MPs would think, well, if it's such a big margin and it looks inevitable it will be defeated again, why would you? Why would you cross that line, you know, and be seen to be helping up to propping up a failed, disastrous Tory deal?
But that's exactly the point I was making, that the issues with this deal are not in substance of the policy substance, they're political, that you don't want to help a Tory government.
Can I add something to that, just to sort of tack on to the back of what Owen was just saying? You also have this problem that if you're talking about a deal as opposed to an outcome that involves a referendum or rescinding Article 50 or that sort of stuff, which is a bit fanciful, I think, still, you need the implementing legislation. So it's not a question of getting a bunch of Labour MPs to vote to support one proposition with some Tories in one vote on one day. You're talking about marching through the lobbies with Tory MPs under a Tory Prime Minister day after day after day through the first, second stages of an implementation bill. And that gets really hard to see.
Yes, and that was something that someone was pointing out to me the other day, that you basically get, if you get a coalition of Tory and Labour MPs to pass the deal, then you essentially have to try and hold together a coalition of those Labour and Tory MPs who become an effective government in a way, to pass all the other bits of legislation that you need up until March. And that starts to become really fractured and impossible, because there are other things that people want on other bits of legislation, like the immigration bill. Well, suddenly that coalition doesn't hold together anymore. Suddenly the coalition doesn't hold together anymore when the actual withdrawal agreement implementation bill, which has to come over to actually legislate for the deal. So the kind of idea that Theresa May is saying, that she wants to reach out and find a compromise, that's a compromise that really has to hold, doesn't it?
I mean, yes, I think that is a very serious difficulty, and we can come on in a minute perhaps to the idea of extending Article 50, which is obviously sort of somewhere near where Labour's policy position may go now. I think that the EU, and we saw some signs in this direction, might be open to certain ideas of extension. They're not open to an idea of extension so you can just get a better deal on the backstop. But what they might be open to is a technical extension that allows you to complete that ratification. And I think it's also, Parliament and politics are in flux at the moment, and things are moving very quickly. So Owen's exactly right to say this was an enormous historic defeat. But of course, this isn't normal times. The reason that we're in this situation is because there was a historic vote with an enormous turnout in a referendum that has led us here, and that's created all this political flux. And then we're in unusual times with a hung Parliament, very, very rare in our political history. So I think, actually, maybe progressively, certain opinions will cool, tempers will change. The Prime Minister also has one very important card in her pack, and she'll be very reluctant to play it, but it is a card. And that's to say that she will not just stand down before the next general election, but she'll stand down at the end of Article 50 and allow a new generation of Conservatives to take forward the country and the leadership. And I think that actually could switch some Conservatives. I've heard various people who are strong critics of the deal on the Eurosceptic side say that they would like something on the backstop, something binding, but they're also concerned that they do not want the Prime Minister leading the next phase of the negotiations on our future partnership, and they want to have a different candidate in that role.
I think that, I mean, that's a very interesting proposition. I agree that I can see the tactical utility of that, but when you zoom out a bit, you think it's quite extraordinary to think we'd go through this process. It would be Theresa May's Brexit, Theresa May's deal. She did the last 2 years has seen an absolute intertwining of the project of leaving the European Union with the character, temperament, personality, judgment and politics of this one woman. And then the final solution would be that sort of you'd get through it, she would, and then she would have to sort of fall on her sword. Instead of having the great celebration, fireworks, get let off, look, we're
free. But she'd absolutely be able to have that celebration. She'd leave on a high. She would be able to, I think she would go as the Prime Minister for the Conservative Party who delivered Brexit.
I used to subscribe to the Theresa May as a hostage theory, fleetingly at least, which was, you know, she doesn't really want to be here after the general election. She's trapped. The Tories will throw away
Melania Trump style
when the Brexit process is finished. And I was just completely and utterly wrong about that. I think everything we know about Theresa May is that she's desperate desperate to stay on, and if her deal, it will be seen as against all the odds. You know, this was an impossible situation she was in, and she did it. A tremendous vindication, a tremendous triumph. If she gets this deal through, she is staying. She's staying for a long time, I think.
I think it's quite a classic thing, actually, that prime ministers do that. They start to confuse their own longevity with the national interest. And I think that is something that Theresa May probably will do. It certainly was against a lot of her instincts to promise to go when she faced that no confidence vote. But I want to move on, and I think it will sort of play into talking a bit about Theresa May's personality and talk about this idea of reaching out to other parties. You know, she had these party leaders come in and see her at the moment Corbyn's refusing to go and see her. It's just window dressing, isn't it?
I don't think it is. I think that clearly she wants to try and secure a wider support in the Commons. I think the difficulty is that obviously the Labour Party's official position is that Brexit has to deliver the exact same benefits as membership. That is literally impossible, as the European Commission have repeatedly said. And I think Jeremy Corbyn, I understand politically why he's refusing to talk to her, but this is a man who's willing to talk without preconditions to Hamas and the IRA and not willing to talk to the Prime Minister. I mean, I think it's playing into her hands and making her look statesmanlike and making him look like he's not interested in a serious discussion. Actually, if I was Jeremy Corbyn, I'd go in there and say, this is our condition, we want a permanent customs union, and then you turn the table onto her.
Raph, what do you think? Do you think Corbyn's made the right call, or do you think that's...
I'm slightly inclined to agree with Henry that tactically the thing to do would have been to say, by all means, we're our door's open too, we're happy to talk. You go in, you say, well, you know, sadly, you know, I just don't get any sense that this Prime Minister understands the gravity of the situation, is ready to change it. And you do it that way. I mean, but what we do know is that temperamentally, and I think it's just a sort of an accident and a misfortune of history, we have these two leaders who are both in their own ways so disinclined to make that kind of dialogue work anyway. I don't think anyone seriously imagines, I think, you know, for reasons that Henry said, Jeremy Corbyn, he's not going to be seen to be complicit in anything that sort of props up Theresa May or helps deliver her Brexit. And actually, an interesting thing about Theresa May is that she is quite unusual among Tories in that she is actually as sort of tribally, culturally steeped in her Toryness and conservativeness as many Labour people are with Labour. And actually, the desire, the attachment to something that will deliver a Brexit that actually satisfies very Eurosceptic Tory instincts is very, very strong. And I just don't think anything that we've seen from the last 2 years of her, you know, or longer, of her politics leads you to think she's actually got the agility, imagination, intellectual flexibility, diplomatic capability to make work the kind of process that she's talking about. But, you know, tactically, yes, I think it was the right thing for her to do. And I think broadly speaking, in terms of what it looks like out there in the country, if anyone bothered to tune in at 10 o'clock last night, probably, yeah, they would think, well, Jeremy Corbyn, why? Yeah, exactly. You know, so if you're not a Derby or a Southampton fan, then you might have watched it and you think, why isn't Jeremy Corbyn going to talk? That's a bit weird. So it was a kind of minor tactical win for her, but I don't think we all know it's a bit performance.
I mean, it's nonsensical. I mean, you know, she obviously declared her door was open in front of a closed door, and I know that's a cheap. I know that's cheap, but I thought the imagery was pretty accurate in that sense. I mean, I think in the sense that, you know, as Nick Bowles, the Tory backbencher, put it, she's going through this whole process acting as though she has a majority of 150, rather than being someone who obviously lost her majority in the last general election. She, during the debate yesterday, she, you know, offered no meaningful concessions, no sense she was going to, you know, make any allowances towards the Labour position. Some argued, well, she has to do that during the vote of no confidence debate because she doesn't want to even risk the idea that any ERG members would start abstaining or whatever. But then afterwards, she makes that speech, and again, it was, to coin a phrase, nothing has changed. Now, in that context, what is the point of engaging in a discussion when it's clear she, as things stand, she's not made even a hint that she will make any meaningful concessions?
The Lib Dems have suggested that they won't actually support any further confidence votes. I actually think this isn't a bad, clever tactic, because they say actually what the Labour Party policy is to now move on to a second referendum, and therefore we won't be part of any games which is delaying Labour moving on to that position. So until Labour does, then we won't support any further. Is that any? I mean, there are not very many of them, but does that kind of put a bit of clever pressure on Jeremy Corbyn?
I mean, I think the Lib Dems are playing with fire, given obviously one of the albatrosses around their necks is the fact they propped up a Tory government for 5 years to then be seen to be doing the same all over again. But no, I mean, with the second referendum issue, I mean, I think it is important for clarity to point out, and this always triggers groans for some reason, but it is still the truth, that Labour Party policy, as agreed at conference, was a priority was to call an immediate general election. If that didn't happen, then Labour had to support all options on the table, including a second vote. But just in terms of what would happen, let's just take that scenario seriously. So a Labour source, sympathetic, supportive in fact, of a second referendum, they said if Labour whips it in favour of a second referendum, there would be 150 to 160 Labour MPs. We'd lose about a quarter of the parliamentary Labour Party, maybe around 20 to 30 Tories. You'd probably be clearer on that. No, so even if you tag on the Nats and the Lib Dems, nowhere near, just absolutely nowhere near. So Labour would have to, you know, and forget the rights and wrongs of a referendum and how bitter and divisive. We've done the referendum thing. I think we've seen what that's done to our politics. It's certainly been an interesting experience for all of us. I'm sure we'd all agree. But, you know, the bitterness, the alienation it would cause, the fact that Leave, I think, have every chance of winning all over again on a ticket of tell them again.
Absolutely.
When actually, you know, given
people's votes are Blairite conspiracy sort of arguments.
Well, given the you know, how disastrous the Brexit process has been self-evidently, in my opinion, the fact that there is no clear, meaningful, significant lead amongst Remain. I mean, people always say, where's the big lead for Labour over the Tories, given how disastrous they are? And I always go, well, where's the big lead for Remain? And those two things are actually linked in lots of ways. So what Labour would do in the current context is, if they supported a second referendum, which would fail in Parliament, they would have to risk alienating their Leave voters and gain absolutely nothing. If they did a free vote, and that's the only way they would avoid resignations from the Shadow Cabinet, I've spoke to Shadow Cabinet members who have told me, I will resign if I am whipped to support a second referendum.
Yeah.
So even if Labour goes through that tumult, and there will be, or not just the Shadow Cabinet, other front benchers will resign as well. If they then did a free vote, well, clearly what will happen then is...
You might get a three-way split.
Well, what was put to me, another Labour backbencher who resigned from the front bench, who is more supportive of Norway Plus, put it to me that actually on a free vote, most of the Parliamentary Labour Party would not support a second referendum. But the problem now is, in the Parliamentary Labour Party, is you've got one chunk who basically would entertain a second referendum, but definitely not Norway Plus, and another chunk who are in the exact vice versa situation. It's a very difficult situation to be in. But this idea of a second referendum being this big red button, which the Labour leadership, regardless, actually, there are different
just
opinions.
Just waiting for the moment to press it.
Well, there's different opinions within the Labour leadership over the second referendum, and people don't actually seem to realise that. I mean, you know, you've got a range of opinion from the Lexiteers. But then if you take Diane Abbott, who people always forget is the single most influential Labour MP in Jeremy Corbyn's inner circle, is far more supportive of the Remain argument. So it's complicated.
Despite having been, as she said herself recently, a Eurosceptic for a lot of her time in Parliament.
Well, no, well, the left critique of the EU in its existing form. But I think this is the thing which I find baffling. And I just want to see what people think about this. For a long time, the left was always accused of putting principle ahead of power, about being a protest party. And their opponents within the Labour Party styled themselves Clause 1 socialists after Clause 1 of the Labour Constitution, which commits Labour to being a parliamentary party with the implication of aspirations for national and local government. And yet, Labour, the way of explaining, because I know everyone goes on, well, it's actually because they really want Brexit and all the rest of it. The brutal reality is they are utterly, utterly desperate to win the next general election. They think this is a historic moment to get a left government elected. And now when they're trying to construct an electoral coalition, because the only way Labour can win the next general election is by, yes, keeping on board their Remain voters.
Winning Leave seats.
But they've got, you know, the vast majority of the Tory seats they need to win voted to leave the European Union. Unless they win in the Midlands, particularly older Leave-leaning voters, they won't be able to do all the things they actually want to do, tax the rich, nationalise industries, repeal
anti-trade rights. If I was Jeremy Corbyn, though, what I would do is ultimately let Brexit pass with a version of the deal, and then you can fight the next election on the NHS and on schools and on funding and whatever else you want to fund. Just going back to the Libs for a second, I think this is one of the most fascinating things that's happened in the last few years. The disappearance of the Third National Party for reasons that Owen explained. They were punished for the coalition period. Also, by the way, a lesson in breaking manifesto promises, putting up student fees when they promised so definitively not to. That should be something that all parliamentary parties now have on their mind. If we don't deliver this Brexit mandate, it could be very difficult for any party with the electorate. But I thought it was interesting recently. Joe Swinson's been Vince Cable. They've been very, very low impact recently. But Joe Swinson was on, I think it was Question Time with Emily Thornberry, and really gave Emily a very hard time about Labour's position. And it was quite effective, just saying, you know, where are you actually going on this Brexit policy overall? And I understand, for the reasons that Owen was saying, that Labour are in this complete bind, where if you move towards supporting Brexit, you upset your activists, you upset a lot of your core seats, and if you move the other direction, you make it much harder to ever win a majority. But then, you know, could it be that over the next few weeks, months, and that we start to see the Libs actually beginning to strengthen?
Yeah, I'm slightly doubtful about that, just because I think there's definitely a problem with Vince. I think he's Vince Cable. I just think he never quite got over the sense of himself as a sort of a commentator who stood aside and you know, the great sage of pre-2010. He, you know, when he was in coalition, he tried to be a cabinet minister and a bit of a dissident at the same time. They've had their sort of what thunder was available to them stolen by the sort of People's Vote campaign. Any kind of Lib Dem recovery definitely starts with change of leadership. And then more broadly, I think, you know, you have this sense now that the Remain energy that there is out there in the country demanding second referendum is also going to be fundamentally anti-Tory in many respects. And therefore, I think actually, from just a purely tactical point of view, the Labour calculation surely has to be find a way to facilitate a Brexit that is soft enough that it really splits the Tories, and then message it in such a way that at least enough of your Remainers understand that it was sort of inevitable, it had to happen, and they've got nowhere else to go. And I think that tactically, that's the sort of discreet sort of Labour as midwife to Norway, but still pummel, you know, shovel as much blame as you can onto the Tories, is a perfectly tactically sensible thing for Labour to do now. I mean, I wouldn't like it because I like the EU, but I mean, I accept that that's a relatively marginal position.
I want to wrap this up with just a final predictions for next week. We've just literally just been told, Andrea Leadsom says, that the Commons will vote on the next step of Brexit on January the 29th, which will be a government motion, and there will also be amendments from others, and we might see Norway amendments and plenty of other amendments too. So what's going to change between now and then? I'm going to ask for your predictions. Henry, what will change between now and then?
I think to go back to the old joke, I don't think very much will change. Nothing has changed, said the Prime Minister before, and I think it's going to be true again, that we're going to see potentially attempts by Parliament to take control. I think that's rather worrying, because although I think we've seen some degree of chaos and a lot of division, there's a narrative that goes, well, in the 2.5 years since the referendum, the facts have become so much clearer. I think if you read the Hansard and watch the parliamentary debates over the last few days, you realise that there is an extraordinary amount of unicorn chasing and magical thinking on all sides of the Brexit debate. And if you have Parliament in charge and you have the division bell ringing repeatedly, MPs rushing from vote to vote after, on amendment after amendment, I'm not sure that will lead to good, rational, clear decision making. But ultimately, the same three choices are going to be there. No deal, no Brexit, or a version of the Prime Minister's deal that's actually been agreed.
Owen, what's going to happen between now and then? Will Labour move its position?
I think that's a very good question, actually. And I think the problem I think we all have is when we speak to people in key positions, they shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know what's going to happen next either. I think it'll be interesting to see if something like Norway has its time in the sun. And, you know, this proposal, the IPPR did this, the think tanker, you know, back in 2017, the shared market proposal. You have possibility of divergence of EU regulation, but with known proportionate consequences, so it's not cakeism and all that. I mean, the Labour leadership are not sold on Norway Plus at all, in fact.
Keir seems to be very, very anti it.
Very much, yeah, and there's just the issue of the arithmetic, the parliamentary arithmetic I just detailed against the second referendum could easily be put against that proposal.
Can
as well.
Can I just say one very quick thing on that, which I think if you go for Norway Plus, you create exactly the same cliff edges that you were warning about before, Owen, because you would have it in the political declaration, we'd be in the transition, and the EU would say, sure, we can negotiate something like Norway Plus, but by the way, can we do a bit of fish? Can we do a bit of money? Can we do a bit of Gibraltar? And we'll be over a barrel, desperate to get Norway Plus locked down. They're not going to give us exactly Norway, and we'll have the same negotiation gradient that you were rightly identifying before.
Well, we'll see if it has its time in the sun, because we'll have to discuss all those. There's no, I mean, my own view is obviously we're talking now about no good options. It's there are only bad options on the table. But Labour's position is obviously, you know, they're desperate to keep on side their Leave voters, and the Leave voters, they need to win a next general election without alienating their Remain voters. How they manage to keep that, because you know, the position has held to now, but now it's obviously colliding with political reality, it's far more challenging to sustain that, of course.
In answer to your question, Jess, I think the one thing that will change is you have to now, two things actually. One, I think the sense that Article 50 extension is inevitable will become more salient, because for the practical implementation reasons. And the other one is this really clarifying this distinction between the withdrawal agreement and the political declaration, and effecting some separation of those to try either put pressure on Labour MPs to say, just do the blooming withdrawal agreement and then argue about the political declaration. That's your way to seal off no deal. I think that will also become more salient in the debate.
Thanks all so much, and I'm sure we'll have plenty more to discuss in the coming weeks.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February, and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now, away from the Westminster Circus, there are warnings that Brexit is already having very real effects on our public services. Mara Aroldi is the director of the UK's Government Outcomes Lab, a research group that aims to revolutionise public services. And it has serious concerns that Brexit is draining the resources of the civil service to such an extent that we'll have a lost generation of public services. She joins us now. So Mara, outline for us, how is Brexit affecting the civil service?
Brexit comes at the end of a long period of austerity, where we already were managing in a sort of like crisis situation, dealing with the fire on the table. Now, Brexit is exacerbating that and is making it worse. It's very, very difficult to get attention from central government. Everybody is only talking about Brexit. I often think that speaking with the civil service now is like talking to a mother taking her children to school, and it's 8:30 in the morning. She has four children to get out of the door, and you're asking her about dinner on Sunday. She can't listen. So the total bandwidth is completely shrunk.
And it's actually about a physical allocation of resources, isn't it? Because there's quite a lot of civil servants who are just being moved off their day jobs to work on no deal contingency planning and other things to do with Brexit, aren't there?
Yeah, there are about like 10,000 civil servants. And my understanding is that last week there were 4,000 who were moved to prepare for a Brexit no deal scenario. So the civil servants have to park what they're working on, because we need to manage with this crisis.
Can you give us an example of some things that might have been delayed or you know, put on ice for, or maybe even cancelled completely because of the pressures of delivering Brexit?
Well, I don't have a particular example in mind, but I know many people have been moved from the Department of Work and Pension. And we know they're really working hard on the universal credit. It's problematic. And we need to tackle the problem and see what is working, what is not working. If we take people away from their department, those problems are just going to grow.
What do you think the risks are to kind of public services and the way that they're functioning and the rollouts? You mentioned universal credit and the rollout of complicated schemes like that because of these pressures.
I think the risk is, research talks about mental bandwidth. The ability to think in the long term, to have a broad perspective. When we are in a crisis, we think about solving the immediate problem, that is tomorrow. And this will create bigger problems for the future. My expectation is that we will stop spending money on prevention, because it's the easy one. We need to respond to immediate crisis. And this is going to create for us a bigger problem tomorrow, when prediction are GDP is going to be lower, tax revenues are going to be lower, and we are just creating a massive problem for our citizens in a few years.
What is your biggest fear of the long-term impact on that? I mean, another thing, that's example that kind of springs to mind for me is things like social care, which is you know, we're expecting a green paper on that, and was long been delayed, a very difficult and toxic subject as well for the Conservatives. What are your fear about, you know, the long-term impact of delaying things like that?
This is really depressing and dire. But can I say that at heart, I am an optimist. And I do think there are ways, like, especially because you mentioned social care, what comes to my mind is the work that Donna Hall is doing in Wigan, in Manchester. she managed by focusing on prevention to save money and improve outcomes. So there are possibilities there, even in challenging problems like adult social care, but you need a strong leader who has a mandate to do things differently. There are some of these heroes in this country. How did they do it? Can we empower them to do that? If we don't, we will have so many people left on their own, families having to meet the cost of private social care because the threshold for accessing social care will have to go up. And we will be a very, very poor country.
Maya Eroldi there. Well, that's it for this week. My thanks to all my guests, Owen Jones, Raphael Baer, Henry Newman and Maya Eroldi. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.